Good afternoon, and welcome to today's program, hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Kathy Curtis. It is my pleasure to introduce Mark Bittman, New York Times columnist and author of How to Cook Everything Fast, A Better Way to Cook Great Food. Mark Bittman is a food movement visionary and one of the country's most recognized food writers. His award-winning books and articles have helped Americans change the way we eat and gain a better understanding of growing health, food, agriculture, and environmental challenges. Mark is the New York Times opinion columnist, lead food writer for the Times Magazine, and frequent TV show guest, Today Show guest. He has hosted four TV series, including Showtime's Emmy Award-winning climate change documentary, Years of Living Dangerously. His popular books include How to Cook Everything, Food Matters, and Eat Vegan Before Six. They have sold millions of copies worldwide, and in 2012, Mark was inducted into the James Beard Who's Who of Food and Beverage in America. Moderating this afternoon's conversation is Naomi Starkman. Naomi is the founder and editor-in-chief of Civil Eats, civileats.com, a daily news source about the American food system and the 2014 James Beard Foundation's Publication of the Year. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Mark Bittman and Naomi Starkman.
Hey.
Hey.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today. Kathy, thank you for the introduction. I'm really thrilled to be here with Mark today. I met Mark Bittman many years ago. I don't know if you remember this story, but Mark wrote one of his seminal food policy pieces. At that time, it was in the Week in Review, and it was called The Meat Guzzler. And it was about the United Nations, a report called The Long Shadow of Livestock Agriculture. And I wrote him a note, and, you know, he didn't know me from Boo, and he wrote me back. And he said, thank you for writing. And he said, this is really important.
This never happens anymore.
I was lucky, he wrote me back. So I'm really pleased to sit here today with Mark and to talk with him about his new book, How to Cook Everything Fast, and also about your questions, and Mark is such a visionary and a leader in thinking around food systems. So I welcome your questions. Please feel free to send them up my way. And I would just want to start talking a little bit about FAST, just by shorthand to call it FAST, and a little bit about, you've said that it's the cookbook now. Tell us a little bit about what inspired you to do FAST and sort of what you think about it in terms of the home cook and how it will help us all learn how to cook more regularly.
I guess there's three answers to that question. One is that any book you write, whether it's a cookbook or a novel or a work of historical nonfiction or whatever, any book you write, it reflects who you are and where you are when you're writing it and the times and stuff. And I do think that FAST is the book that I needed to write right now. And it does represent where I'm at and how I cook. And it also represents a lot of work and a lot of thought. And I'll get to that. The second thing is when the original How to Cook Everything was published in 1998, there were two or three responses. One is, this thing is too big. It's too daunting. I can't get into it. I don't know what to do. I want to cook something. I don't want to cook everything. The second was, I want pictures. And the third was, can't we just have something where, like, everything is fast? So the first two things seemed seemed like there was a very specific audience for that, for the pictures thing especially, and for fewer recipes for more basic stuff. So I did 2 or 3 years ago How to Cook Everything, the basics, which has 1,000 photographs because we do things big, and it's a really nice book. But by then we had decided to do something called How to Cook Everything Fast. But we didn't, when I say we, there's a big team here. We didn't want to do what some other cookbook authors have done, which is collect obviously fast recipes and put them in a book and say, here's how to cook everything fast. We wanted to, after much deliberation, we decided we wanted to take away the excuse. The main excuse people use for not cooking is, I don't have the time, I don't know how to do it, it scares me, please help. I mean, we get that a lot. And we thought, let's just not throw a bunch of traditional recipes that happen to be 30 minutes or less at people. Let's really try to make it so that people understand what cooking is about, how it can be easy, how it can be fun, and how it can be done quickly. So we spent 5 months figuring out how to write a recipe and what this book was going to look like. And it's as much a design, it was as much a design challenge as it was a writing challenge. How are we going to represent the dance of cooking, the choreography of cooking, what cooks actually do when they go in the kitchen? And the result is what's in this book, which is really only four or five different formats or templates, but each of which we think represents what cooks do when they cook, what experienced cooks do, and we can get into that. But so the book is for anyone who wants to cook better, anyone who wants good ideas about how to cook faster, but I think especially for people who are afraid or say they don't have the time to cook or learn how to cook.
There's no such thing as no time to cook. And one of the reviews I read about the book by Tim Carman in the Washington Post, he said, speed is the new sex. And he calls the book a recipe-rich tome, and it's 2,000 recipes that places an emphasis on food preparation, not food porn photos. And as you mentioned, there are no photos. One of the things I think that's really amazing about the book is the design of how the recipes are on the page. And you also have this unique way of telling people how to prep as they're cooking, which I think is one of the most important things the book really introduces to the home cook.
Well, that was the 5 month speed is not the new sex, by the way. That, I like Tim very much, but that's just... That's like writing to get attention. That's
it's a good soundbite.
Right. So this choreography I was talking about. Here's what traditional recipes look like this. You have this ingredient list. It's always a box, right? You have this ingredient list, and it says 1 cup chopped onion, 1 tomato sliced, 1 teaspoon salt, 1/2 teaspoon cinnamon, 1/4 teaspoon allspice. What else might go in this fictional recipe we have here? 1 pound cubed lamb, 1 cup white wine. You get the idea. And the idea was that this is called mise en place. This is putting things in their place. And the idea, if you look at it, is that you gather all those things. You chop your onion, you slice your tomatoes, you cut up your lamb, you measure very carefully your spices, you take out your white wine, you pour a cup of it into a cup, and then you look at the recipe, and the recipe says preheat the oven to 400 degrees. You just spent 20 minutes on a 20-minute recipe, maybe. So we thought, well, how do you make this recipe? What is going on when you make this recipe? And so we devised this. Those of you who are holding the book can see this. The rest of you can look later. But we devised this way of doing a recipe that, by using two colors, blue and black, we do prep and cook, and prep and cook, and prep and cook. And we take advantage of the fact that cooking takes time. There are never going to be any zero-second recipes. When you put the onion in the oil, the onion has to change. Otherwise, there'd be no point in putting it in the oil. So you have to wait for the onion to change, to soften or to brown or whatever it is you're doing with it. While that's happening, you can stare into space, or you can stir the onion way too much, which most people do, or you can do the next thing that you're supposed to do. So if you walk in the kitchen and you put the pan on the stove and you turn the flame on under the pan and you put the oil in the pan, then you go chop the onion while the oil is heating, which it has to do, right? Because otherwise, what's the point of putting it in the pan? Then you put the onion in the oil. Then while the onion is softening, you cube that lamb or slice that tomato or whatever. Then you put that in the pan. And while the lamb is browning or the tomato is turning into sauce, You take out your white wine, you shove in your spices, you do that. While that's happening, you get the idea. And not every recipe can be written this way, but most can, and not every recipe is fast, but the ones that we thought could be rejigged to be fast are in here, and some of them don't sound like fast recipes. So we have meatloaf, we have spanakopita, we have chicken parmesan, we have wonton soup, we have apple crisp. We have all these things that by shaving time here, by shaving time there, and by doing things in a more organized fashion, they qualify as fast, either under 45 minutes or under 30 minutes, or in rare cases, admittedly, under 20 or even 15 minutes. I can do chicken parmesan in 20 minutes now, and I think it's a better chicken parmesan than, you know, frying a chicken breast, making a tomato sauce, putting a bunch of mutz on it, and putting it in the oven, all of which, you know, uses a lot of equipment and takes 45 minutes or an hour. So broiled ziti, that's another very clever recipe we do, which is basically baked ziti but spread over a bigger surface so that it browns and the cheese melts twice as fast, three times as fast. So there's a lot of innovation here. You could call it tricks, but it's not tricks in the sense that you need to learn to do anything differently. It's just like, here's some stuff that five or six people talking every day, cooking the same kinds of recipes over and over, trying to figure out how to make progress in this one particular arena, and then working with a designer, with two designers really, who understood how best to try to represent that on the page, this is the result. And I think it's super cool. And modesty aside, I think it's super cool. And I do think it's the right book for right now. And if I'm wrong, you know, life goes on. But if I'm right, it's a sort of a bit of a game changer. So we'll see.
One of the questions you're getting a lot on book tour is about ingredients. And I've heard you say in various places, you know, that you need to have a well-stocked pantry. You don't need to have 150 ingredients. You just need to have the ones that you can put together, the semblance of a basic meal. And so I want you to maybe talk through with us a little bit what you have in your kitchen cabinet. When you come home after a long day working, writing, doing all the things you're doing, what are you throwing together?
You know, I think actually you do need to have 150 ingredients, but you don't need to have 150 ingredients tomorrow. So the bad question is, and I'm glad you didn't ask it this way, the bad question is, what five ingredients do I need to have in my pantry? And to me, that's like saying, which 5 minutes should I sleep tonight? No, that's the wrong question. The question is, how much sleep do I need? And the question is, what do I need in my pantry? And everybody needs a different pantry. But most people need 20 or 30 spices and herbs. They need 10 or 20 or even 30 things in bottles that range from olive oil to soy sauce to fish sauce to sesame oil to mustard to two or three kinds of vinegars, etc. They need 10 or 20 things that sit around in jars like white rice and brown rice and barley and blah, 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 grain-wise, and a few kinds of different beans and pasta and stuff like that. They need some stuff that stays in the refrigerator that lasts a long time, like onions and eggs and Parmesan cheese. They need things that are particular to the way that they cook, like coconut milk or curry powder or curry paste or anchovies or capers or so on down the line. Or they need all of that stuff. I basically have all of that stuff. And I basically have all of that stuff all the time. So if I come home empty-handed, I can make pasta or fried rice or soup or any number of things that can be done, you know, without fresh fish or fresh meat or fresh vegetables. If I come home with fresh fish or fresh meat or fresh vegetables, I can use any of that stuff in the pantry to make pretty much any dish in the world. I mean, close to any dish in the world. So certainly any dish in this book. So the pantry is super important, and it can range from all, it can have, you know, I sometimes keep frozen vegetables in my freezer because I just know that frozen vegetables are better than no vegetables. And in general, cooking from your pantry is still going to be better than doing takeout. So, I think it's important to have. It's not, the number of ingredients is not that important, but since they keep forever as you keep cooking, that number of ingredients tends to grow, because this is not stuff that, you know, mustard, no one's ever seen mustard with mold on it. I mean, you might be able to do that, but it, you know, it doesn't happen in our lifetimes. I don't know.
Stock. I know you're not a huge fan of canned or packaged stock.
I mean, I think if you taste canned stock, you won't use it. I mean, it's fine to use canned stock because you put it in and the flavors of whatever you're cooking overwhelm it. But if you drank canned stock, taste canned stock with a food, I don't care if it's from a can, I don't care if it's organic, I don't care if it's like got a groovy name on it, I don't care if it costs $4 a can, it doesn't taste good. If you're lucky enough to buy if you're lucky enough to buy stock that someone else made and it's good, that's great. But for the most part, I don't use stock. I use water. Sometimes if I want a little more flavor, I use water that's been simmered for a minute or 10 minutes with a carrot, a piece of celery, an onion. But basically, stock is just flavored water. So if you're cooking something with a lot of flavor in it and you put water in it, it turns into stock while you're cooking. Obviously, if you add good stock, you wind up with more flavor. But cooking is about compromise. So we never have enough time, we never have the right ingredients, we never have as much skill as we want to have. And I've always acknowledged that, and I think that it's important to acknowledge that. It's not going to be perfect. You're trying to put dinner on the table. You're not trying to be Thomas Keller. So there's a big difference between those two things. And if you're trying to put dinner on the table, you have to acknowledge right up front it's not likely to be the best meal you ever had in your life. And that's true for everybody. I mean, I acknowledge that every day. I'm just trying to put something that I really want to eat on the table. It's not going to be French laundry. It's going to be okay.
And one of the great questions from the audience already is that they love the How to Cook Everything app, and will there be a How to Cook Everything Fast app?
The more people that ask that question, the more likely the answer is yes. It takes a long time to do those apps, and I would say look for it in a year. Buy the book in the meantime. The book has amazing binding. By the way, those of you who have owned the yellow, especially How to Cook Everything, have seen it fall apart, for which I apologize. It wasn't my doing, but I'll apologize anyway. This book has amazing binding. It will lie flat. The binding will not break. It's a really nicely... One of the reasons it's so heavy is that it's of quite high quality, I will say, production-wise.
And another question, you talk a lot about tools. So I've been known to be a one-pot wonder. I have a pot and a pan. And moving my way up, I have some good knives and some cooking utensils. But you talk a lot about tools. I know you're a big fan of scissors. What do you think are sort of the essentials for people who are just getting into home cooking?
I think one pot and one pan is a great way to start. I mean, a small skillet, a medium skillet, a large skillet, a small saucepan, a medium saucepan, a large saucepan. That's pretty well stocked. A roasting pan, a broiling pan, some utensils like tongs and spoons and so on. You don't have to go much farther than that, but in a way it's like the pantry. If you're into pies, you're going to need to buy a rolling pin and a pie plate. If you're doing a lot of slicing or shredding or pureeing, you're going to want a food processor, or you might want a food processor. But these are things that you can decide about. No one should say to you, the basic equipment costs $2,000 and takes up all your counter space and you now have 40 things, or you need to go buy an all-clad set that costs $750 because otherwise you can't cook. It's just, you know, you buy stuff, you use it. If it breaks or it wears out, you throw it out and buy it again. You're only going to live, with luck, 90 years. So if you replace your... If you replace your pans four times in the course of 90 years, not that big a deal. That's my feeling anyway. So the
Mark Bittman message is not just do it, just cook it. Just do it. Get in the kitchen and cook.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, for any given dish, you're only going to need two pans at most and a couple of spoons and maybe that food processor, maybe not, maybe that roasting pan, maybe not. But you're not going to need, you know, a kitchen full of stuff.
So you've said that you started writing out of self-defense.
Cooking out of self-defense.
But you've been writing about cooking for a while, and you've also said that people weren't interested in your writing until you started writing about food.
Well, that's true. I wrote for a community newspaper. I ran a community newspaper when I was in my early 20s, and then in my late 20s, I decided I was going to try to get paid. And no one was interested in anything that I was writing about. And then when I started writing about food, many people were interested in things that I was writing about. And actually at that point, they all saw the error of their ways and let me write about other things also. But it was mostly food that people were interested in. It was mostly food that I wrote about. And that led to my first book, Fish, and later How to Cook Everything, and the Times Minimalist column. And so I wrote about food, but pretty much exclusively cooking for almost 30 years. And then, as you said, I wrote that Week in Review piece, Taming the Meat Guzzler, and I started to break out a little bit. And I'm in debt to many people, but I'm in debt especially to people like Eric Schlosser and Michael Pollan, who showed that there was an audience for writing about food in the bigger sense, not just cooking. And then I'm indebted to the people at the Times who, when I pushed to have a voice like that at the Times, saw that that was a reasonable thing. I'm also a little bummed out because the work is really hard. So
it is really hard. So let's talk a little bit about your food writing. I'm sure this audience here, being in the Bay Area, is very well aware of a lot of the issues that that you're writing about. More recently, you had a big piece in the food issue last week in the New York Times Magazine. You had a cover story in Time Magazine. You had a great column this past Wednesday. And just to sort of drill in a little bit about some of the bigger topics around food, in the piece that you had in the food issue, you write about how you had kind of this less than perfect or ideal upbringing in your own sort of food experience. But then you share with the readers, and maybe we can talk a little bit with the audience here, about how you raised your children to be curious eaters. And that piece is a lot about how to get your kids to eat, at least try everything. And you have some great advice in there, and I was hoping you would share that a little bit with us.
I was very lucky because I started writing about food almost simultaneously with the birth of my first daughter. So I don't think it's a coincidence. I think I've done some things right in my life, and that was one of them. And I was lucky because I got to cook and call it work. But my kids were not so lucky, at least if you're a person who believes in spoiling your kids and feeding them what they want to eat, because I was cooking different stuff every single night. I never cooked the same thing twice. And my daughter Kate says, well, there was the time you cooked squid every night for 2 weeks, but that never happened. I think I probably cooked squid 5 times in the course of 2 weeks. And then she told, and I did write this in the piece, she tells this story of coming home and there being an octopus in the sink. And she's like, oh, hell no. But the deal in my house, I was really lucky to be married to someone who agreed. We agreed totally about this. She was lucky too. We just said, we're going to eat the food we want to eat every night, and if the kids don't like it, they can go make themselves something else, only there's not going to be any junk food in the house, so they're not going to go eat Cocoa Puffs for dinner. So that was the deal. And I'd say 3 nights out of 4, 6 nights out of 7, whatever, the kids would eat what I made. And I wasn't trying to make crazy stuff just to torture them. I just made whatever it is. I would go on JAGS. We would have Indian food, 15 nights in the course of a month. But that, so they learned to like Indian food. And then if they didn't, they'd eat peanut butter sandwiches, or they'd eat yogurts, or some yogurt with honey, or they'd eat fruit and cheese. They'd eat whatever there was, and it worked. They're great eaters. They're grown, normal, wonderful women. They cook, they eat, I don't think they have any hang-ups about food at all. It's really quite remarkable. They're way less crazy about food than I am, I think, for example. But I grew up in a much more difficult situation.
So what do you advise parents? There's some parents I know, their kids will only eat white food.
When a kid is, the white food indulgences. I mean, as I also said this in the piece, when my kids' friends would come over, I would indulge the hell out of them because I was damned if I was going to have some screaming four-year-old who belonged to somebody else at my dinner table. So when we had the kid over, Abby, who only ate white food, I just make a pot of white rice. And we'd have white rice with whatever we were eating, and she ate white rice. I don't think there's a lot of advice. The advice is keep saying to them, eat what we're eating or go make something by yourself. I mean, if they're two, they can't make something by themselves. But, you know, I think when they're two, you can sort of figure out something that's a standby that you can, you know, if you're having pasta with some weird sauce and the kid really doesn't like it, you can make pasta with something super simple. But I think eventually, you know, if you can't teach a kid to eat pasta with broccoli, something is wrong there. Something's really wrong. Either you're not trying hard enough or there really is something wrong. But everybody should be able to eat pasta with broccoli. I mean, it's like normal. So
there's a great photo of Mark's daughter, if you guys haven't seen it, in the New York Times Magazine, holding up a stalk of broccoli.
But she was in a high chair. Right. So I don't know. That means she was probably 12 months old or something. She's waving the stalk of broccoli. It's a pretty funny picture. Then there's a picture of her a year later sitting tearing apart a lobster, which is pretty cool.
So what do you do, though, when you're, you know, if you can't, you're not in a situation at home and you can't control what you're, you can control what you're eating or what your kids are eating, but what do you do when the kids are outside the home? And this is sort of a bigger question I want to ask
it
you about, which is, you know, you've got, there's some of the side effects of not home cooking is that we've sort of relinquished a lot of control to the industrial food complex. And so there's insidious marketing, junk food marketing, fast food marketing to kids. So your kid leaves your house and goes and then wants to eat this food. So as a parent, what do you do in those circumstances?
It raises two issues that you and I both raise all the time. And the issues are part of the answer to this question is personal and part of the answer to this question is environmental or political. So anyone can make a decision to feed their kids well or to eat well, him or herself, at any time. Anyone can make that decision and anyone can execute that decision. We can all start eating better tonight. But not everybody's going to do that, and certainly those of us or those who are subjected to the intense marketing of big food are more likely to submit to that and to be when certainly kids, when not under the control of their parents, are more likely to go out and eat Chicken McNuggets or really bad pizza or, you know, fries especially, and or red hot Doritos or, you know, any number of millions of things. So there's two issues here. One is that we can decide to cook better food for ourselves and our kids, and that's a discussion and that's a big issue. The other issue, which is equally big, is we need to improve the environment so that it makes it easier to make good choices. Because what we've done is spent, not we, I'm not taking blame for this one, what we've done is spent the last, or we've allowed big food to spend the last 50 or 60 years making it so that the food environment is, as David Kessler says, a food carnival. There's food everywhere, all the time, it's not that expensive, and it's bad. And a lot of it doesn't qualify even as food, if you look up the definition. I mean, it could be said that it's closer in nature to poison than it is to food, in that it makes you sick instead of making you healthy. And yet that's what we see everywhere. We see non-food everywhere. And I think for individuals, the choice is I'm going to ignore or try to ignore this 80% of food that's out there that I know is not good for me and concentrate on the 20% that I know is good for me. And that's the most important decision you can make in food. But to reduce the size of that 80% slice or chunk of what's out there being called food, to make junk food and hyper-processed food and industrially raised meat and a smaller wedge of the pie, a smaller chunk of the range of what we call food, that's something we can't do individually. We have to do together, and that's political, that's environmental, that's about changing the food system and about establishing a real food policy, because we don't actually have a food policy in this country. We have anarchy, and anarchy means if you can make money growing it and selling it, more power to you. And you can make money in the state of Iowa, you can make money by growing nothing but corn and soybeans. But all corn and soybeans produce are junk food, animal feed, and ethanol. And you don't want to eat any of that stuff. So you've got probably the second best growing state in the country, California being the best, growing stuff that's really not that useful to us.
So
I could go on, you can tell.
Well, I have other questions, so we'll drill in a little bit more. So one of the questions from the audience was what food policy initiatives you've seen that have been inspiring in sort of recent years. What have you seen that's making you hopeful?
Well, the improvement of, I mean, it's not a, without giving the Obama administration too much credit, but they deserve some credit because school lunch programs have improved during the course of this administration. Not much else has. I mean, sadly, the FDA and USDA in general have not done us a lot of good in the last 6 years, and I'm really disappointed in that. The initiatives that the biggest initiatives that I've seen that I liked the most were the vote to put labeling, health labeling on soda in California, which I was really excited about. I thought was a great idea, and of course lost. And the various efforts to tax soda, which I think is probably not as good a strategy as labeling, but is an interesting strategy and a good strategy, and one that I guess I'll say appears to have a good chance of passing in Berkeley, at least, probably not in San Francisco.
Tell us a little bit about why you think that.
Well, I think Berkeley, first of all, Berkeley is, you know, the People's Republic of Berkeley and all of that. So you have a shot. But also Berkeley crafted the measure so that it only needed a 50% majority to pass, and then the money will go into the general fund. San Francisco, more ambitiously to its credit, said, well, the money from soda taxes is going to be targeted toward wellness programs, toward public health. And that is that's a very good thing. But to target tax money for a specific, what's that called? Yeah, thank you, earmarks. I was like, eye holes? Earmarks. I'm glad you knew. It would have taken me 5 minutes. To earmark money, you need a two-thirds majority. So in San Francisco, which is less of a, you know, it's a much bigger city than Berkeley. It's not overall as progressive a city as Berkeley. And you need a tougher majority to achieve. I think the chances are less good than they are in Berkeley. But you know what? I think San Francisco's measure is much better. It's twice as good as Berkeley's, literally, because it's 2 cents per ounce tax versus 1 cent per ounce tax. And the money's earmarked, and that's really great. But I would be so happy to see this thing pass in Berkeley, and I think this is really a snowball. This is, people will see, oh yeah, soda consumption goes down, and we've seen this because Mexico passed a national soda tax just January 1st of this year, and soda consumption is projected to go down by 10% this year, which is really incredible. And two, this money can be used for public health. And that's exactly what's happened with tobacco taxes. You see a decrease in use, not big enough, but you see a real decrease in use, and the money is used for smoking cessation programs. It's imperfect, it needs to get better, but it's way better than letting marketers try to sell soda to two-year-olds successfully and then have people grow up thinking that soda is a normal beverage, which it isn't.
Just a reminder, you're listening to this week's Commonwealth Club program featuring Mark Bittman, author of How to Cook Everything Fast and a food columnist for the New York Times. I'm Naomi Starkman, founder and editor-in-chief of CivilEats.com. So you had this great column in last week's paper, in your Opinionator column, about how to change the food system. And it was called Do Sweat the Small Stuff. And it was a really personal column. It was about being on book tour and being tired and how you're being sort of deluged with questions from everybody, from every corner, about how to change things. And you had sort of a great list of questions that you're being asked and answers that you're trying to answer. But you also sort of drilled in and said, you know, it's such a big, complex machine, but we can change our own relationship to food. And I was hoping we could talk a little bit about some of those answers you provided.
Okay, why don't you read them then?
Sure.
Because you sure don't expect me.
Sure.
I mean, as spaced out as I was when I wrote that column, that was Monday or Tuesday, and
well,
it's almost Monday or Tuesday again.
True.
So
it's true. And lucky.
And
for
how
you,
many
I have
cities
a...
have I been in since then?
Probably a few.
Well, that was Seattle. So.
And you've been to
four
LA.
Since then.
Yeah.
Well, this makes five. Yeah.
So the first question in the piece was how to change the food system, and the answer was slowly, one step at a time. The second was, how do you define real food? And your answer was, it existed 100 years ago.
These are good answers. These are good answers.
What do you think about GMOs? And your answer was, both fear and benefits are overrated. What are the biggest problems in food? Unregulated junk, unregulated marketing, barely regulated antibiotics. So you say, if you care about real food and you keep caring about it, it almost doesn't matter what your job is. Just help make real change one step at a time.
You know, I thought that was, in a way, you're the first person who brought that sentence up, and in a way, that was the only new thing I've ever written. And that, because everything else there was, I mean, it's not rehashed, it's rethought, but, anyway, I'm not ashamed of it. But I did like that, because when you go to, I've spoken on some college campuses, and I was in a room with 60 or 80 people, and other than, a couple of professors and administrators, they were all under 20. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally. And they say, well, what should I do? I want to work in food. What should I do? And I thought, I'm not going to tell you to become a farmer, and I'm not going to tell you to go get a degree in epidemiology, and I'm not going to tell you to become a politician, and I'm not going to tell you be a lawyer. It doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. If you're interested in working to change food, I think your profession is going to let you do that. If you have a profession where you have some choice about what it is you're doing, if you're teaching, if you're a lawyer, if you're a doctor, if you're a public health person, obviously, if you're a farmer, if you're a cook, if you're a journalist, if really, even if you're a construction worker, you can work to change food by making sure that your kid is getting decent food, that your school system, your local school system is concerned with what they're feeding kids, your city has got some kind of food policy thing. I mean, anybody can. So I used to try to answer that question, and then I realized, no, whatever it is you're doing, if you care about changing food, you can change food. I mean, you can lobby for having your town compost everything. I mean, there's so much to be done. Who said this? Wendell Berry, I guess, I don't know, said there's just so much good work to be done. I mean, you don't have to go looking around for good work to do. There's a lot of it out there to be done.
Right. And you have some other really concrete pieces of advice in that piece, too. And you say, you can start by not purchasing food or boycotting food from McDonald's and PepsiCo, although there are other companies that also deserve your boycott. And you
right.
mentioned cooking as being a cornerstone for creating a more sustainable food system and planting a garden. And so really giving people a way that to feel like these huge overreaching issues, there are small bricks that together we can help to build a new food economy.
Well, I think, when someone says, how do you change the food system? At this point, I just say, poco a poco. I mean, you don't know the answer to that question. You do what you can do today. But when someone says, how can I change what I'm doing? Well, that's easy. That's easily addressed. And I think I just talked about that, the difference between changing the environment, which is difficult and will take some time, but it's one step at a time, or changing your own personal food policy, which is pretty easy. I mean, not for everybody, but many people can do that, and many people can do it today, tomorrow.
And I think that's sort of where you see a market shift change when you have consumers demanding. And you sort of see that happening now with this sort of rise of fast casual establishments and the millennials sort of heading towards Chipotle and other places and sort of leaving McDonald's semi in the dust.
I think McDonald's is being left in the dust. And I think in a way it's unfortunate, not that I'm a fan of theirs, but 5 years ago, when I started writing about this stuff 4 or 5 years ago, I talked to someone on the McDonald's board and I said, isn't it clear you guys are just going to die? And he said, well, it's the problem of the big steamship. It's very, very hard to turn it around. And I think it's a shame that McDonald's can't change quickly enough, and it's a shame that Pepsi can't change quickly enough, but I don't think they can. and I, or at least they won't change quickly enough to maintain their, it's not quite hegemony, but, you know, to maintain their exalted status. Because you do see, you saw Chipotle come almost out of nowhere with, let's face it, not the best food in the world, not the healthiest food in the world, not the ideal food, not the ideal labor policy, et cetera, but much better. A real step in the right direction. And if that sounded critical of Chipotle, it's really not, because I don't want to sound like perfect is the enemy of good. Chipotle showed the way. And now you have, I mean, I don't know what's out here now, but you have Tender Greens, which is really great, and you have Native Foods, which is kind of interesting, and you, on the East Coast we have this thing called Sweet Green, which is really good. And you're seeing people trying new stuff and succeeding. And I don't, no one's going to have the answer. None of the chains I just mentioned is ideal. No one's going to say, we're the new McDonald's, and suddenly they're going to have 10,000. I think McDonald's at its peak had 10 or 12,000 stores in the United States. No one's going to have that in the near future, but you're going to see this chiseling away at McDonald's base, especially with millennials, but with older people too, I think.
So just to kind of talk a little bit about the future of food, and that was part of the Time magazine special around food, and a lot of people were asked about what they see as the future of food, and you've written about sort of this, the next advances, things like being here in the Silicon Valley, things like Hampton Creek Foods and Life Kitchen, and places that are sort of looking at alternatives to meat and other healthier, faster fast food establishments. So in your view of being in California, we're sort of in this bubble in the local sustainable food movement. Where do you see the future of food being?
I've been wrong about many things, so I hate to make predictions. I don't see the high tech thing as really being the answer. I see what's happening here, and what's happening to a much, much, much lesser extent, but to some extent in the greater New York area and probably more in the greater DC area, this kind of regional food system emerging where there's more and more successful small and medium-sized farms, where a greater and greater percentage of our food comes from those places. And it may be 6%. I mean, it's not like it's 70%, but it may be that it's a small percentage, but it's a small but growing percentage. And I think to the extent, again, it's the same duality here. We can buy more of that food. We can support local food. We can support small and medium-sized farmers. We can support farmers who are not growing commodity crops but are growing real food. But I think that only goes so far, and we need to see government support for those efforts as well. And that's the same kind of thing. It's like, what's your personal food policy? I would like to try to buy as much local or regional food as I can. What's the government's food policy? The government's food policy is eat junk food. That's the sad truth. So you're sort of at odds with what the government is supporting and certainly what industry is supporting. But let me just say this one thing again, because I think this is the most important thing I could possibly say. If you look at that broad spectrum of what's called food and you say, I'm eliminating 60 or 80% of this, I'm eliminating the stuff that I consider to be junk. You can define it yourself, because we all know what junk is. But 60 or 80% of the stuff that's sold in supermarkets is junk, and 90 to 95% of the stuff that's sold in fast casual restaurants is junk. If you say, I'm eliminating that and I'm eating real food, and then you say after that, not only am I eliminating real food, I mean, not only am I eating real food, I'm focusing on eating more fruits and vegetables and other plants than I used to eat, because there's hardly a person in the United States who wouldn't benefit by eating more plants than he or she used to eat. You make those two statements, everything else is gravy. Whether it's local, whether it doesn't have GMOs in it, whether it's organic, blah, blah, blah. Those are decisions that are important to make. Those are struggles that are important to fight for. And I know many of us drive ourselves crazy with, was this fair trade? Were the people who raised this stuff paid well, treated well? Were the animals treated well? Is the packaging biodegradable? Are there antibiotics in here? Were GMOs used in its production? All of that stuff, those are all legitimate questions, totally legitimate questions, but I think they are secondary questions to, can I stop eating junk and can I focus on fruits and vegetables? Those are the, if you do those two things, everything else, you can worry all you want about the other stuff, but you've made the big two decisions correctly, and that's an important thing.
Amen. I want to answer some of the, get you to answer some of the questions from the audience. And a lot of the audience has questions about your book, so I want to be sure to get those answered. And this one I just loved, which is, how do you eat healthfully while you're traveling on book tour?
It takes so much discipline, you cannot imagine. It is so hard. And you drop the ball. You just drop the ball, and then... I mean, as some of you know, I've done this diet now going on 8 years called VB6, which is basically I eat only unprocessed fruits and vegetables until 6 o'clock at night, and then I do whatever the hell I want after that. So that allows me to do dinner and to sort of, and it's a great diet for many reasons, and I've written books about it and articles. You can read them or buy them or whatever, but... So yesterday, I had a banana for breakfast, and I had some nuts in the middle of the morning, and I had an eggplant sandwich and a salad for lunch, and I had a couple pieces of chocolate, actually, which is fine, in the afternoon. And I actually wound up having a fairly light dinner. So that was a pretty successful day. Today... I had a banana and oatmeal really early in the morning. I was probably hungry because I didn't eat enough yesterday. And then I went out for dim sum with this guy, and it was like all over. It was all over it. I said, oh, well, dim sum, I can probably ask them for some stir-fried greens, and I'll eat a turnip cake. And, you know, within 5 seconds, there were shrimp dumplings on the table. So so today was not as successful, but it takes a lot of discipline. And look, let's face it, it's not... There's a lot being taken out of you when you're on the you sleep in a different bed every night, you don't see present company excluded, of course, you don't see the people you care about the most, you have to work from hotel rooms and from moving vehicles, and God, I'm making myself so depressed, but so food of course is a comfort, and you say, okay, I deserve this. So it's hard to do VB6, but it's actually not that hard to avoid fast food joints, especially if you're on the West Coast, where most of the, you know, you can find good food pretty much everywhere. So if I, you know, we'll see what happens the week after next, the second week in November, or first week in November, I'm in Atlanta, Indianapolis, Syracuse, and Chicago. So some of that's going to be challenging, although anyone who travels can tell you that food is much, much better overall in the United States than it was even 5 years ago. So that's, I mean, I bet I find good food in Indianapolis and Syracuse.
You have to keep us posted.
Yeah, I will.
One of the questions from the audience is, how do you cook or plan differently for individuals or a couple versus a family?
You know, it's funny, most recipes are written for four, and that's probably an outdated mode of doing things, but because I'm sure that a very small percentage of the people in the United States at this point live in a household of four people. But it is also a convenient number, and it's a manageable amount. It's not cooking for 20, and it doesn't feel, cooking for one sometimes feels a little prissy, like you're just doing little tiny things, and you can do it, I can do it, but I always make too much when I cook for myself. So I think cooking for two is not that hard. But somehow there's something easier almost about cooking for four, and then you have leftovers, which is not the worst thing in the world either.
It leads me to another question, which is about food waste, which is a really important topic, and it's getting a lot of play in the media. More than 40% of the food that we grow and produce in this country is thrown away. And what are your sort of tactics for dealing with food waste in the book?
I mean, I'm a huge proponent of cooking for leftovers, and I'm a huge proponent of eating savory foods for breakfast and for lunch. So whatever you cook, you should eat. But it is a hard question, because I'm also a huge proponent of having a very well-stocked refrigerator. And I like to go to the vegetable store, or the farmer's market, or even the supermarket, and just buy a lot of stuff because I know then I have this refrigerator I can start. If I'm going to be home for 4 or 5 days, I have this refrigerator I can start pulling stuff out of and cooking at will, and I have a lot of choices. That does often lead to some things going bad, which maybe that's inevitable. I mean, you're not going to eliminate food waste. And, you know, I would not argue that it's a good thing. But I would say that we have planned waste built into this so-called system. And I think the real wastes are that we're growing all of this stuff that isn't fit to be eaten in the first place. So I'm not saying throw out whatever you want to throw out. By all means, we should try to eat what we buy and what we order and so on. But we should also be careful not to be wasting our land, our water, our air, or spoiling those things. And we do that.
So, great question. Can you talk about whether this book is actually a return to where you started as the minimalist? If not, how is it more of an evolution than a return?
Well, I didn't start as the minimalist. So I started as... I think I've been very consistent in my cooking. I did spend a couple of years cooking with Jean-Georges Van Gerichten, who's one of the great cooks in the United States, but everything I did with him was try to get him to do stuff more simply so that I and my readers, and hopefully his readers, could understand it. And maybe some corners were cut there that might not have been cut, but that's consistent with who I am. I am a home-trained cook, self-trained cook. I learned how to cook primarily from cookbooks. I've almost never cooked anything fancy, and I've cut corners the whole time, and this book is just a more systematic way of cutting corners. So I think it's really consistent with everything that I've done. I hope I didn't sound defensive. I mean, I'm serious about that, though.
How do you address sort of it's a difficult question, but about people who really are living, you know, from paycheck to paycheck and don't have time, maybe they don't even have enough funds to buy the book or have access to fresh or good ingredients. How can we encourage people to cook more frequently and engage them in that conversation?
You know, I do think that the eat real food message is the most important message. And it's not true that real food is cheaper than junk food, but it may be true that it's not true that junk food is cheaper than real food, but it may be true that junk food is more accessible than real food, and that's a huge problem. So some of this is about how do we get real food into 7-Elevens and into liquor stores that sell food and into all these kinds of places where people are forced to buy food because there's no supermarket or there's not even a bodega anymore or whatever. The second question is, how do we make that stuff readily affordable? The third question is, how do we get cooking back in the schools? Because that's hugely important because people do have children and those children need to learn how to cook. And then I'm sure there's more than 4 points to be made here, but the fourth one I can think of offhand is that in part this is not a question about food, it's a question about justice and a question about inequality, which doesn't mean it shouldn't be addressed, it should be addressed. But at the end of the day, you get to this place where some questions, the best answer is, well, let's work for campaign finance reform, because obviously we need better politicians. So when you get to that point, you're not talking about food anymore. That doesn't make it irrelevant, and it doesn't make it a bad thing to say. It means that talking about food can't address every issue that has to do with food, because food is huge. And it's like healthcare. You can't, you know, it's like... say to doctors, well, how do we manage to treat people who can't come to your office or who can't afford any kind of health care and so on? That's not a medical issue. That's a bigger issue. And a lot of these issues are about how we want this society to be organized.
So one of the questions is, you know, if you were food czar, what policies would you enact?
That's a easy one for me because I often think about becoming food czar. I dream about becoming
food. You already are in
your own mind. I also would like to be transportation czar. So if there was a, probably because I'm a boy, but I think the two most pressing issues that are most easily addressed I obviously I care about cooking and I care about people being able to get real ingredients, and I want there to be, well, I don't have to limit myself to two. Okay, I want there to be home ec and cooking classes in schools. I want there to be cooking classes in community centers. I want fruits and vegetables and other healthy foods to be subsidized and readily available to everybody. I don't think any of that stuff's going to happen very soon. The two things that could happen this year that this administration could make happen and could have made happen are, one, to make it impossible to use antibiotics in the food supply except for when animals are sick. Totally impossible. And they have not done that. And we need to get antibiotics out of the food supply, because that is going to be a public health crisis, or could be, of unimaginable proportions. That's number one. And this could be done easily, and FDA has not done this. Number two is to somehow limit, restrict, eliminate, and the marketing of junk food to kids. And that's another huge issue, because if we want to see healthy adults 20 years down the road, that has to start now. And it's too late for many of us. I mean, it's too late for all of us, unless there are children in this audience, to have had childhoods free of the assault of marketing of junk. And as a result, most of us have eaten our fair share of junk and still continue to struggle with the appeal of junk food. If you stop marketing soda, cheeseburgers, fries, et cetera, to little kids, and then you have a decent school nutrition program, which we're moving towards, then you have kids growing up in a healthier environment. Their cravings are different. Their attitudes about foods are different. And 20 years from now, I think you probably have a much healthier society.
One of the kind of curious questions is about what you like to eat and what you make for yourself, some of your comfort foods.
Well, I say this jokingly, but it's really true. Actually, I say two things jokingly, but they're both true. One is, I used to cook every night and make dates to go out. Now I go out every night and I make dates to cook. So there's a sad truth there. I have to beg people to invite me into their homes and let me cook with them, or I have to be in a city where I have a friend and say, can I come over instead of us going out and cook, or I have to be home, but it's not happening very often. That's number one. Number two, this is really true. I've settled into this pattern where on many, many nights I have vegetables and pasta and salad, or fish and pasta and salad, or fish and salad, or fish and pasta, or vegetables and pasta, or vegetables and salad, and it's all kind of, and if you substitute rice or another grain for pasta, and you substitute occasionally meat for fish, it's kind of how it is every night. But that's what cooking is. You have two or three components, you combine them in a way that makes you comfortable, and that's what makes me comfortable.
Who's inspiring you sort of when you see some of the new cookbooks out there? Where are you looking for recipes when you sometimes are looking elsewhere?
Well, I've always had to, the Italian thing, or even the European thing, comes naturally to many of us because we're of European extraction, and to some extent, whether we're aware or not, most American food is European food. I spent a lot of time in Mexico, and I feel like I still need to learn a lot about Mexican and South American food, but really the challenge to me is East Asia, and it's because I have spent the least time there of any place in the world with great cuisine. So when I still cook from books, they're often Korean, Japanese, Southeast Asian. Those are still challenging and fun to me.
And where are you, when you wake up in the morning and you're looking for news and you want to be informed about food, where are you looking and what are you reading?
Probably sad to say, self-destructively. It's for my big news, I look at the Times. For general stuff, I look at the Times. For food specific, because this cannot leave this room. Oh, wait, this is going to be broadcast on the radio? Can't do it, sorry. Give me a blackboard. For food specific, it's really my Twitter feed, which is, you're in my Twitter feed, and It's not a lot of cooking. I don't really want to read about cooking. I know, you know, again, modesty aside, I know how to cook. It's not that I have nothing to learn, but I love to cook with other people, but I don't really want to read a lot about cooking. And I don't want to read a lot about restaurants. Fortunately, I have friends most places I go who are obsessed with restaurants, so I can call them up and say, where should I go eat? And they just tell me, and they're usually right. So I don't have to think about that so much. But I want to read about food policy, and I want to read about, I guess you'd say, the progressive movement in general, of which I consider the food movement a part. So I follow 70 or 80 people on Twitter, and they're not all food people. I mean, Civil Eats is in there, and Grist is in there, but so is Center for American Progress and Union of Concerned Scientists, and just organizations that I think may or may not address food, but if they do, they're addressing it from the perspective I want it addressed from.
That's great. So we have time for just one last question, and I guess everybody here is dying to know where you're going to be eating while you're in the Bay Area.
You know, but you can't say that because then everybody goes there.
Well, maybe you can mention, I remember once I had given Mark the small tip about Mission Chinese, and he ended up writing a New York Times Magazine piece about it. And are there places that you really like to eat, some places that you visited in the past that you might go to this time?
You know what's funny is... this is another thing I'm going to have to be extremely discreet about. Don't you hate it? I mean, if things were not on the radio, then I can say this doesn't leave this room. And to the extent that anyone pays attention to that, it really doesn't go that far. But when things are broadcast, you can't be specific because you're going to get, it's going to come back and kill you. And I don't want to do anyone any harm. I will say that I ate at a restaurant last night where I've eaten many times before in San Francisco and was disappointed. So now I can't name that. otherwise, I would have recommended it, but now I can't recommend it. And I'm eating a place tonight that I've never heard of. So I could, if you want, I often promise to do this and forget, but I could tweet it tomorrow. And tomorrow night, I'm going out late, and someone else, because I'm speaking at City Arts and Lectures tomorrow night. Tickets still available if any of you are dumb enough to want to hear the same conversation all over again. But at least it'll be at night. You won't have wasted a beautiful afternoon. So I'm going out late with this kid who used to work for me, and he made, I don't even know where I'm really, I'm lying. I can't tell you where I'm going. I'm not going to tell you where I'm going. I will tell you that I wish I were going. How's this? I wish I were going to Camino, which is in Oakland, but I can't make it across the bay. So that's a recommendation for a place where you will not find me. But that's the best I can do, I guess.
And check out at Bittman to find out where he ate tonight.
Yeah, that'll be good.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Naomi. Thank you all.
I hope you all enjoyed this afternoon's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Mark Bittman, author of How to Cook Everything Fast, A Better Way to Cook Great Food, and Naomi Starkman, founder and editor-in-chief of Civil Eats, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.